And another thing, I don't think you should be telling the other patients you're going to take them back with you.
I never said that to any of the patients.
You didn't?
No. In fact, I told them I can only take one person back with me.
I don't think you should be making promises you can't keep.
I've promised nothing.
He bit into a huge strawberry from a bowlful brought in from her garden in Hoboken by Mrs. Trexler. I was famished. My mouth was watering. This time I joined him. Chewing hungrily, we glared at each other for several minutes like prize fighters sizing up an opponent.
Tell me, I said,
if you can leave here any time you want, why do you stay?
He swallowed a mouthful of berries, took a deep breath.
Well, it's as good a place as any to write my report. You feed me every day, and the fruit is wonderful. Besides, he added impishly, I like you.
Well enough to stay put for a while?
Until August 17th.
Good. Now let's get started, shall we?
Certainly.
All right. Can you draw a star map showing the night sky from anywhere in the galaxy? From Sirius, say?
No.
Why not?
I've never been there.
But you can do so for all the places you've been?
Naturally.
Will you do a few of those for me before the next session?
No problem.
Good. Now, where have you really been the past few days?
I told you. Newfoundland. Labrador.
Uh-huh. And how are you feeling after your long journey?
Very well, thank you. And how have you been, Nair?
Nair?
Jean on Capax is Nair.
It rhymed with hair. I see. Is that from the French, meaning to confess?
No, it is from the Paxo, meaning one who doubts.
Oh, and what would prot be in English? One who is cocksure?
Nope. Prot is derived from an ancient Capaxian word for sojourner. Believe it or not, by Ripley.
If I asked you to translate something from English to Paxo for me, something like Hamlet, for example, could you do it?
Of course. When would you like to have it?
Whenever you can get to it.
Next week, okay?
Fine. Now then, we've talked quite a bit about the sciences on Capax. Tell me about the arts on your planet.
You mean painting and music, stuff like that?
Painting, music, sculpture, dance, literature. The usual smile broke out and the fingers came together.
It is similar in some ways to the arts on Earth, but remember that we have had several billion years longer to develop them on Capax. Our music is not based on anything as primitive as notes, nor any of our arts on subjective vision.
Not based on notes? How else?
It is continuous.
Can you give me an example? With that, he tore a sheet of paper from his little notebook, began to draw something on it. While he did so, I asked him why, with all his talents and capabilities, he needed to keep a written record of his observations.
Isn't it obvious? He replied. What if something happens to me before I get back to Capax?
He then showed me what he had drawn.
This is one of my favorites. I learned it as a boy.
As I tried to make sense out of the score, or whatever it was, he added,
You can see why I'm rather partial to your John Cage.
Can you hum a few bars of this thing?
You know I can't sing. Besides, it doesn't break down into tunes.
May I keep this?
Consider it a souvenir of my visit.
Thank you. Now, you said that your arts are not based on subjective vision. What does that mean?
It means we don't have what you call fiction.
Why not?
What is the point?
Well, through fiction one often gains an understanding of truth.
Why beat around the bush? Why not go right for the truth in the first place?
Truth means different things to different people.
Truth is truth. What you are talking about is make-believe, dream worlds. Tell me,
he bent over the notebook,
why do human beings have the peculiar impression that a belief is the same as the truth? because sometimes the truth hurts. Sometimes we need to believe in a better truth.
What better truth can there be than truth?
There may be more than one kind of truth.
Prout continued to scribble in his notebook.
There is only one truth. Truth is absolute. You can't escape it no matter how far you run.
He said this rather wistfully, it seemed to me.
There is another factor, too, I countered. Our beliefs are based on incomplete and conflicting experiences. We need help to sort things out. Maybe you can help us.
He looked up in surprise.
How?
Tell me more about your life on K-Pax.
What else would you like to know?
Tell me about your friends and acquaintances there.
All K-Paxians are my friends, except there is no word for friend in Paxo, or enemy.
Tell me about some of them, whoever comes to mind.
Well, there is Brote, and Mano, and Swan, and Fled, and...
Who is Brote?
He lives in the woods, Rilward of Reldo. Mano is...
Reldo?
A village near the Purple Mountains.
And Brote lives there?
In the woods.
Why?
Because orphs usually live in the woods.
What's an orph?
Orphs are something between our species and trods. Trods are much like your chimpanzees, only bigger.
You mean orphs are subhuman?
Another of your famous contradictions in terms, but if you mean is he a forebear, the answer is yes. You see, we did not destroy our immediate progenitors as you did on Earth.
And you consider the orphs to be your friends?
Of course.
What do you call your own species, by the way?
Tremors.
And how many progenitors are there between trods and Dremors?
7.
And are they all still in existence on K-Pax?
May we.
What are they like?
They're beautiful.
Do you have to take care of them in some way?
Only clean up after them sometimes. Otherwise, they take care of themselves, as all beings do.
Do they speak? Can you understand them?
Certainly, all beings speak. You just have to know their language.
Okay, go on.
Mano is quiet. She spends most of her time studying our insects. Swan is soft and green. Fled is
green.
Of course, Swan is an M. Something like your tree frogs, only they're as big as dogs.
You call frogs by name?
How else would you refer to them?
Are you telling me you have names for all the frogs on K-Pax?
Of course not, only the ones I know.
You know a lot of lower animals?
They are not lower, just different.
How do these species compare with those we have on Earth?
You have more variety, but on the other hand, we have no carnivores. And,
he beamed,
no flies, no mosquitoes, and no cockroaches.
Sounds too good to be true.
Oh, it's true, all right, believe me.
Let's get back to the people.
There are no people on K-Pax.
I meant the beings of your own species, the, Dremors.
As you wish.
Tell me more about your friend Mano.
I told you she is fascinated by the behavior of insects.
Tell me more about her.
She has soft brown hair and a smooth forehead, and she likes to make things.
Do you get along well with her?
Of course.
Better than with other K-Paxians?
I get along well with everyone.
Aren't there a few of your fellow Dremors that you get along with that you like better than others?
I like all of them.
Name a few.
That was a mistake. He named 60-odd K-Paxians before I could stop him with,
do you get along well with your father?
Really, Gene, you've got to do something about that memory of yours. I can give you some tips if...
How about your mother?
Of course.
Would you say you love her? Love implies hate.
You didn't answer my question.
Love, like, it's all a matter of semantics.
All right, let me turn that around. Is there anyone you don't like? Is there anyone you actually dislike?
Everyone on CAPEX is just like me. Why would I hate anyone? Should I hate myself?
On Earth, there are those who do hate themselves. Those who haven't lived up to their own standards or expectations. Those who have failed to achieve their goals. Those who have made disastrous mistakes. Those who have caused harm to someone and regretted it later on.
I told you before, no one on CAPEX would cause harm to anyone else.
Not even unintentionally?
No.
Never?
Are you deaf?
No, I hear you quite clearly. Please, calm down. I'm sorry if I upset you. He nodded brusquely. I knew I was onto something here, but I wasn't certain as to the best way to proceed. While he was composing himself, we talked about some of the patients, including Maria and her protective alter egos. He seemed quite interested in her condition. Who knows where inspiration comes from, or is it merely a momentary clearing in the fog of stupidity? In any case, I realized at that moment that I had been focusing, perhaps for reasons of self-interest, on his delusion. What I should have been attacking was the hysterical amnesia. Prot. His fists slowly unclenched.
What?
Something has occurred to me.
Bully for you, Dr. Brewer.
I was wondering whether you'd be willing to undergo hypnosis at our next session.
What for?
Well, let's call it an experiment. Sometimes hypnosis can call up recollections and feelings that are too painful to recollect otherwise.
I remember everything I have ever done. There is no need.
Will you do it as a personal favor to me? He eyed me suspiciously. Why do you hesitate? Are you afraid to be hypnotized? It was a cheap trick, but it worked.
Of course not.
Next Wednesday, all right?
Next Wednesday is the 4th of July. Do you work on your American holidays?
God, is it July already? All right. We'll test your susceptibility to the procedure next Tuesday and begin the week after that. Does that suit you? Suddenly calm.
Perfectly, my dear sir.
You're not planning on leaving again, are you?
I'll say it one more time. Not until 3:31 a.m. on the 17th of August.
And he returned to Ward 2, where he was welcomed back like the prodigal son. The next morning, Giselle was waiting at my office door when I arrived at the hospital. She was wearing the same outfit as before, or perhaps one of its clones. She was all tiny tooth smiles.
Why didn't you tell me about Prot?
She demanded. I had stayed up until 3 o'clock to finish some editorial work, had come in early to prepare a speech for a Rotary Club luncheon, and was still distraught over Prot's temporary disappearance. My office clock began to chime, further jangling my nerves and telling me what I didn't want to know. What about him? I snapped.
I decided to make him the focus of the piece, with your permission, of course.
I dropped my bulging briefcase onto my desk.
Why Prot?
She literally fell into the brown leather chair and curled into the already familiar ball. I wondered whether this was premeditated or whether she was unaware of the charming effect it had on middle-aged men, especially those suffering from Brown syndrome. I began to understand why she was such a successful reporter.
Because he fascinates me, she said.
Did you know that he's my patient?
Betty told me. That's why I'm here, to see if you would let me look at his records.
Her eyelids were fluttering like the wings of some exotic butterfly. I busied myself with transferring the contents of my case to some logical place on the already overcrowded desk. Prot is a special patient, I told her. He requires very delicate treatment.
I'll be careful. I wouldn't do anything that would jeopardize my own story, or divulge any confidences, she added in a playful whisper. Then, I know you're planning to write a book about him.
Who told you that? I practically shouted.
Why, he, Prout told me. Prout? Who told him?
I don't know, but I want to assure you that my piece won't affect your book in any way. If anything, it should drum up some business for it. And I'll show it to you before I submit it for publication. How's that?
I stared at her for a moment, trying to think of some way out of this unwanted complication. She must have sensed my doubt.
I'll tell you what, she said. If I can identify him for you, I get my story. Fair enough?
She had me, and she knew it.
Plus any expenses I might incur, she added immediately.
Over the weekend, I reviewed the transcripts of all 8 sessions with Prout. Everything pointed to at least one violent episode in his past which precipitated his hysterical escape from the real world, which he deeply hated, to a non-existent idyllic place where there are no human interactions to cause all the problems, large and small, that the rest of us have to live with every day, nor the joys that make it all worthwhile. I decided to ask Prout to spend the 4th of July at my home in order to see if a more or less normal family environment would bring anything out of him I hadn't seen before. I had done this with a few other patients, sometimes with beneficial results. My wife was in favor of the idea, even though I mentioned to her that Prout may have been involved in some sort of violent affair, and there was a possibility that...
Don't be silly, she interrupted. Bring him along.
How these things happen, I haven't a clue, but by Monday morning, everyone in Wards 1 and 2 knew that Prout was coming to the house for a barbecue. Almost every patient I ran into that day, including 3 of Maria's alters, who kept fastening buttons unfastened by other personalities and vice versa, complained good-naturedly,
"You never invited me to your house, Dr. Brewer."
To every one of them I said, "You get well and get out of here, and I'll do exactly that." To which most of them replied,
"I won't be here, Dr. Brewer. Prout is taking me with him."
All but Russell, who had no intention of going to K-Pax. His place was on Earth. Indeed, with everyone in Wards 1 and 2 enjoying a picnic on the hospital lawn, except for Bess, who stayed inside out of an imaginary rainstorm, Russ spent all of the 4th in the catatonic ward, preaching the Gospels. Unfortunately, none of those pathetic creatures jumped up and followed him out. That same Monday morning, Giselle was waiting for me again in her usual outfit, same piney bouquet. I asked her as politely as possible to please call Mrs. Trexler for an appointment whenever she wanted to see me. I started to tell her that I had many patients to see, a lot of administrative work, papers to referee, letters to dictate, and so on. But I had barely begun when she said,
"I think I know how to track down your guy."
I said, "Come in." Her idea was this. She wanted to have a linguist she knew listen to one of the interview tapes. This was one of those people who can pinpoint the area of the country where one was born and or grew up, sometimes with uncanny accuracy. It is not based on dialect so much as phrasing, whether you say water fountain or bubbler, for example. It was a good suggestion, but impossible, of course, owing to patient-client privilege. She was ready for this.
"Then can I tape a conversation with him myself?"
I saw no compelling reason she should not, and told her I would ask Betty to arrange a time convenient for her and Prout.
"Never mind." She grinned slyly. "I've already done it."
And she literally skipped away like a schoolgirl to get in touch with her expert. Her piney aura, however, stayed with me for the rest of the day. Session 9. It was a beautiful 4th of July, partly cloudy skies. I wonder why it's always in the plural, how many skies are there. Not too hot or humid, and the air redolent of charcoal grills and freshly cut grass. A holiday seems to generate a feeling of timelessness, bringing, as it does, blended memories of all those that came before. Even my father took the 4th off, and we always spent the day around the brick barbecue pit and the evening at the river watching the fireworks. I still live in my father's house, the house I grew up in. But we don't have to go anywhere now. We can see the nearby country club display right from our screened-in terrace.
Even so, when the first Roman candle lights up the sky, I invariably smell the river and the gunpowder and my father's Independence Day cigar. I love that house. It's a big white frame with a patio as well as the second-story terrace, and the backyard is loaded with oaks and maples. The roots are deep. Right next door is the house my wife grew up in, and my old basketball coach still lives on the other side. I wondered, as I gathered up the sticks and leaves lying around the yard, whether any of my own children would be living in the house after we've gone, picking up loose twigs on the 4th of July, thinking of me as I thought of my father. And I wondered whether similar thoughts might not have been buzzing around Shasta Daisy's head as she sniffed around her predecessor's little wooden marker, barely visible in the back corner behind the grill. Daisy the Dog, 1967-1982. By 2 o'clock, the coals were heating up, and the rest of my family began to arrive. First came Abby, with Steve and the two boys, then Jennifer, who had brought her roommate, a dental student from Palo Alto. Not a man, as we had thought, but a tall African-American woman wearing copper earrings the size of salad plates that hung down to and rested on her bare shoulders. And I do mean tall. As soon as I saw Steve, I told him about the variance between Charlie Flynn's description of the figure-eight orbit of Capax around its twin suns and Prout's version, which, if I understood it correctly, was more of a retrograde pattern like that of a pendulum. Later I showed him the calendar and the second star chart Prout had concocted, the one describing the sky as seen from Capax looking away from Earth. Steve shook his head in disbelief and drawled that Professor Flynn had just left for a vacation in Canada, but said he would mention all of this to him when he got back. I asked him whether he knew of any physicists or astronomers who had disappeared in the last 5 years, particularly on August 17, 1985. To his knowledge, there had been no such disappearances, though he joked that there were a few colleagues whom he wished might quietly do so. Freddie arrived from Atlanta, still wearing his airline uniform, alone as usual. Now everyone was here for the first time since Christmas. Chip, however, had better things to do and soon went off somewhere with his friends. Just after that, Betty showed up with her husband, an English professor at NYU, who happens to have a black belt in Aikido. They had brought Prout and one of our trainees, whom I had invited primarily because he had been an outstanding amateur wrestler, and he, too, would be helpful in case Prout showed any indication of turbulence. Shasta Daisy, extra nervous when so many people are present, barked at everyone who arrived from the safety of the underside of the back porch, her usual refuge. Prout came bearing gifts, 3 more star maps representing the heavens as seen from various places he had visited, as well as a copy of Hamlet translated into Paxo. He hadn't been out of the car for 5 seconds, however, before an extraordinary thing happened. Shasta suddenly ran at him from the porch. I yelled, afraid she was going to attack him. But she stopped short, wagged her tail from ear to ear, as only a Dalmatian can, and flattened herself against his leg. Prout, for his part, was down on the ground immediately, rolling and feigning with the dog, barking even. And then they were up running all over the yard, my grandsons chasing along behind, Shakespeare and the charts blowing in the wind. Fortunately, we managed to recover all but the last page of the play. After a while, Prout sat down on the grass, and Shasta lay down beside him, bathing herself, utterly calm and content. Later, she played with Rain and Star for the very first time. Not once did she retreat to the porch the rest of that afternoon and evening, not even when the nearby country club celebration started off with a tremendous bang. She became a different dog that 4th of July. As, so to speak, did we all. That night, after the fireworks were over and our guests had gone, Fred came into the family room downstairs, where I was shooting some pool and listening to the Flying Dutchman on our old hi-fi set. For years I'd had the feeling that Fred wanted to tell me something. There had been times during pauses in conversations when I was sure he was trying to get something off his chest but couldn't quite bring himself to do it. I never tried to push him, figuring that when he was ready he would tell me or his mother what was bothering him. That's not entirely true. I didn't press him because I was afraid he was going to tell us he was gay. It is something a father doesn't ordinarily want to hear,
Most fathers are heterosexual, and I'm sure his mother, who will not be satisfied with less than 8 grandchildren, felt the same way. Apparently motivated by a conversation with Prout, Fred decided to come out with it. But it wasn't to tell me about his sexual orientation. The thing he had tried to bring up all those years and couldn't was his deep-seated fear of flying. I have known dentists who quake at the sight of a drill and surgeons who are terrified to go under the knife. Sometimes that's why people get into those fields. It's a form of whistling in the dark. But I had never encountered an airline pilot who was afraid to fly. I asked him why on earth he had decided on that profession, and he told me this. I had mentioned at dinner years before that phobias could be treated by a gradual acclimation to the conditions that triggered them, and had given some examples, such as fear of snakes, of closets, and, yes, of flying. I had taken him with me to a conference near Disneyland when he was a boy, having no idea he was apprehensive about the flight. That was why he went to the airport the day after he graduated from high school and began to take flying lessons, to work out the problem on his own. It didn't help, but he continued the training until he had soloed and flown cross-country and passed his flight test. Even after all that, he was still afraid to fly, so he figured the only thing to do was to enroll in an aeronautical school and become a professional pilot. He obtained his commercial license, became an instructor, hauled canceled checks all over the eastern seaboard, usually in the middle of the night and often in bad weather, and after a couple of years of that, he was as horrified as ever at the prospect of leaving terra firma. Then he got his air transport ticket, as he called it, and went to work for United Airlines. Now, 5 years later, after a brief conversation with Prout, he had finally come to me for help. We were a long time down in the family room, playing ping-pong and throwing darts and shooting pool as we talked. 9 years a pilot, and he still had nightmares about plunging to Earth from awesome heights, taking forever to fall through empty space, falling and falling and never reaching the ground. I have had many patients over a quarter century of practice who are afraid of flying. For that matter, it is quite common among the general population, and for a very simple reason. Our ancestors were tree dwellers. As such, a fear of falling was of considerable evolutionary value. Those who did not fall survived to reproduce. Most people are able to overcome this fear, at least functionally. On the other hand, there are some who never go anywhere they can't get to by car or train or bus, no matter how inconvenient. I explained all this to Fred and suggested that he very likely fell into the latter category. He wanted to know what he should do. I suggested he try some other line of work.
"That's exactly what Prout said,"
he cried, and for the first time in 2 decades, he hugged me.
"But he thought I should talk to you about it first."
I had never seen him so happy. My sigh of relief turned out to be premature. Right after Freddy had gone, Jennifer came in, pink from a shower. She grabbed his cue stick, took a shot, missed. We talked a while about medical school, shooting all the while, until I noticed that she hadn't pocketed a single ball, which was unusual for her. I said, "Is there something you wanted to talk to me about?"
"Yes, Daddy, there is."
I knew it was something I didn't want to hear. She hadn't called me Daddy in years, and she had also been talking to Prout. But it sometimes takes Jenny a while to get to the point.
"I saw you hugging Freddy," she said. "That was nice. I never saw you do that before."
"I wanted to, lots of times."
"Why didn't you?"
"I don't know.
Abby thinks you weren't much interested in our problems. She figured it was because you listened to other people's troubles all day long and didn't want to hear any more at home."
"I know. She told me tonight before she left. But it's not true. I care about all of you. I just didn't want you to think I was trying to interfere with your lives."
"Why not? Every other parent I know does."
"It's a long story." She missed another easy shot.
"Try me."
"Well, it's because of my father, mostly, your grandfather."
"What did he do to you?"
"He wanted me to become a doctor."
"What's wrong with that?"
"I didn't want to be a doctor."
"D- Dad, how could he have made you go to med school? He died when you were 11 or 12, didn't he?
Her voice cracked charmingly on 11 and 12. Yes, but he planted the seed and it kept growing. I couldn't seem to stop it. I felt guilty. I guess I wanted to finish the rest of his life for him. And I did it for my mother, your grandmother, too.
I don't think you can live someone else's life for them, Dad. But if it's any consolation, I think you're a very good doctor.
Thank you. I missed my next shot. By the way, you didn't go to medical school because of me, did you?
Partly, but not because you wanted me to. If anything, I thought you didn't. You never took me to see your office or the rest of the hospital. Maybe that's why I became interested. It seems so mysterious.
I just didn't want to do to you what my father did to me. If I haven't told you before, I'm very happy you decided to become a doctor.
Thank you, Dad.
She studied the table for a long minute, then missed the next ball entirely, sinking the cue ball instead.
What else would you have done, if you hadn't gone into medicine, I mean?
I always wanted to be an opera singer. At that she smiled the warm smile she inherited from her mother, the one that says, "How sweet." That annoyed me a trifle. "What's the matter?" I said. "Don't you think I could have been a singer?"
"I think anyone should be anything he or she wants to be," she replied, not smiling anymore. "That's what I wanted to talk to you about."
With that, she missed the 12 ball by a mile. "Shoot," I said.
"It's your turn."
"I mean, what's the problem?" She threw herself into my arms and sobbed,
"Oh, Daddy, I'm a lesbian."
That was about midnight. I remember because Chip came in right afterward. He was acting strangely, too, and I braced myself for another revelation. Chip, however, had not talked to Brot. Even my grandsons behaved differently after that momentous 4th of July. They stopped fighting and throwing things and began to bathe and to comb their hair without arguing about it, an almost miraculous change. But back to the cookout. Prout wouldn't eat any of the chicken, but he consumed a huge Waldorf salad and a couple of gallons of various fruit juices, shouting something about going for the gusto. He seemed quite relaxed and played frisbee and badminton with Rain and Star and Shasta all afternoon. Then something happened. When Karen turned on the sprinkler so that the kids could cool off, Prout, who appeared to be enjoying himself, suddenly became extremely agitated. He didn't turn violent, thank God, just stared for a moment in utter horror as Jennifer and the two boys splashed into and out of the spray. Suddenly he started screaming and running around the yard. I was thinking, "What the hell have I done?" when he stopped, dropped to the ground, and buried his face in his hands. Shasta was by his side in a second. Betty's husband and our trainee looked at me for instructions, but the only one I had was, "Turn off the goddamn sprinkler!" I approached him cautiously, but before I could put a hand on his shoulder, he raised his head, became as cheerful as ever, and started to frolic with Shasta again. There were no further incidents that afternoon. Karen and I had a lot to talk about that night, and it was nearly dawn when we finally got to sleep. She wanted to know what Freddie would do after he left the airline, and she cried a little about Jenny. Not because of her choice, but because she knew it was going to be hard for her. Her last words before drifting off, however, were, "I hate opera." Giselle was waiting for me the next morning, jumping up and down, nearly beside herself.
"He's from the Northwest," she exclaimed. "Probably western Montana, northern Idaho, or eastern Washington."
"That's what your man said?"
"She's not a man, but that's what she said."
Wouldn't the police know if someone, especially a scientist, had disappeared from that part of the country 5 years ago?
They should. I know someone down at the 6th Precinct. Want me to check for you?
For the first time in several days, I had to laugh. It appeared she knew someone in any line of work one could name. I threw up my arms. "Sure, why not? Go ahead." She was out the door like a shot. That same morning, Betty, wearing an enormous pair of copper earrings in another desperate attempt to get pregnant, I presumed, brought in a stray kitten. She had found it in the subway station,
and I assumed she was going to take it home with her that evening. But instead, she suggested that we let the patients take care of it. The presence of small animals in nursing and retirement homes has proven to be of great benefit to the residents, providing badly needed affection and companionship, and generally bolstering their spirits to such a degree that lifespans are actually increased significantly. The same may be true for the population at large. To my knowledge, however, such a program had not been introduced in mental institutions. After due consideration, we are an experimental hospital after all, I asked Betty to instruct the kitchen staff to see that the kitten was fed properly and decided to let it roam wards 1 and 2 to see what would happen. It headed straight for Prot. A short time later, after he had nuzzled it for a while and spoken to it, it went out to meet the other inhabitants of its new world. One or two of the patients, notably Ernie and several of Maria's alters, stayed away from it for reasons of their own. But most of the others were delighted with it. I was especially surprised and gratified to see that Chuck the curmudgeon took to it immediately.
"Doesn't stink a bit," he averred.
He spent hours tempting it with bits of string and a small rubber ball someone had found on the grounds. Many of the other patients joined in. One of those, to my amazement, was Mrs. Archer, who, I discovered, had owned numerous cats before coming to MPI. But the most remarkable effect of the kitten was on Bess. Unable to sustain a relationship with another human being, she became totally devoted to La Belle Chatte. She assumed the responsibility for feeding her and emptying her litter box and taking her for romps on the grounds. If anyone else wanted to play with the kitten, of course, Bess immediately gave her up with a wise, sad nod as if to say,
"You're right. I don't deserve to have her anyway."
But when night came, La Belle invariably sought out Bess, and the staff would find them in the mornings sharing the same pillow. After a few days of this, I began to wonder whether another kitten or two might not have an even greater salutary effect on the patients. I decided to get a tomcat later on and let nature take its course. Session 10. There are two probes available for penetrating the carapace of hysterical amnesia. Each has its proponents, each has its place. The first is sodium pentothal, also called truth serum. A reasonably safe treatment, it has met with some success in difficult cases, and is favored by many of our own staff, including Dr. Villers. Hypnosis, in experienced hands, offers the same possibilities, but without the potential risk of side effects. With either method, events long forgotten are often recalled with amazingly vivid clarity. When I learned hypnosis as a resident many years ago, I was skeptical about its value in psychiatric evaluation and treatment. But it has begun to come into its own in recent years, and is the method of choice in the management of many psychopathologies. Of course, as with other methods, success depends not only on the skill of the practitioner, but also, to a great degree, on the disposition of the patient. Thus, the hypnotizability of the subject is routinely determined before treatment is initiated. The Stanford test is used most often for this assessment. It takes less than an hour and provides a measure of the patient's ability to concentrate, his responsiveness, imagination, and willingness to cooperate. Subjects are rated on a scale of 0 to 12, the higher numbers indicating the greatest hypnotic susceptibility. Psychiatric patients, as well as the general public, average about 7 on this test. I have known a few 10s. Prot obtained a score of 12. My purpose in using hypnosis in Prot's case was to uncover the traumatic event which had led to his hysterical amnesia and delusion. When had this incident occurred? My best guess was August 17, 1985, approximately 4 years and 11 months earlier. The plan was simple enough, to take Prot back to his childhood and carefully bring him up to the time of the putative traumatic event. In this way, I hoped not only to determine the circumstances that led to whatever catastrophe had apparently befallen him, but also to get some information on the background and character of my patient. Prot seemed to be in good spirits when he arrived in my examining room, and While he went to work on a pomegranate, we chatted about Waldorf salads and the infinite number of possible combinations of fruit juices. When he had finished his snack, I turned on the tape recorder and asked him to relax.
"I'm completely relaxed," he replied.
"Good. All right. I'd like you to focus your attention on that little white spot on the wall behind me." He did this. "Just stay relaxed. Breathe deeply, in and out, slowly, in and out. Good. Now, I'm going to count from 1 to 5. As the numbers increase, you will find yourself becoming more and more drowsy, your eyelids becoming heavier and heavier. By the time I get to 5, you will be in a deep sleep, but you will be able to hear everything I say. Understand?"
"Of course, my beings didn't raise no dummies."
"Okay, let's begin now. 1. Prout was a textbook subject, one of the best I ever had. By the count of 3, his eyes were tightly closed. On 4, his breathing had slowed and his facial expression had become completely blank. On 5, his pulse rate was 40 BPM. I was beginning to be concerned. 65 was normal for him, though he looked okay, and he made no response when I coughed loudly. "Can you hear me?"
"Yes."
"Raise your arms over your head." He complied with this request. "Now lower them." His hands dropped into his lap. "Good. Now I'm going to ask you to open your eyes. You will remain in a deep sleep, but you will be able to see me. Now, open your eyes." Prout's eyes blinked open. "How do you feel?"
"Like nothing."
"Good. That's exactly how you should feel. All right. We are going back in time now. It is no longer the present. You are becoming younger. Younger and younger. You are a young man. Younger still. Now an adolescent. And still you are becoming younger. Now you are a child. I want you to recall the earliest experience you can remember. Think hard. What do you see?"
"I see a casket. A silver casket with a blue lining."
My own heart began to beat faster. "Whose casket is it?"
"A man's."
"Who is the man?" The patient hesitated for a moment. "Don't be afraid. You can tell me."
"It is the father of someone I know."
"A friend's father?"
"Yes."
Prout's words came out rather slowly and sing-songy, as though he were 5 or 6 years old. "Is your friend a boy or girl?" Prout squirmed around in his chair.
"A boy."
"What is his name?" No response. "How old is he?"
6.
"How old are you?" No response. "What is your name?" No response. "Do you live in the same town as the other boy?" Prout rubbed his nose with the back of his hand.
"No."
"You are visiting him?"
"Yes."
"Are you a relative?"
"No."
"Where do you live?" No response. "Do you have any brothers or sisters?"
"No."
"Does your friend have any brothers or sisters?"
"Yes."
"How many?"
2.
"Brothers or sisters?"
"Sisters."
"Older or younger?"
"Older."
"What happened to their father?"
"He died."
"Was he sick?"
"No."
"Did he have an accident?"
"Yes."
"He was killed in an accident?"
"No."
"He was hurt and died later?"
"Yes."
"Was it a car accident?"
"No."
"Was he injured at work?"
"Yes."
"Where did he work?"
"At a place where they make meat."
"A slaughterhouse?"
"Yes."
"Do you know the name of the slaughterhouse?"
"No."
Do you know the name of the town your friend lives in? No response. What happened after the funeral?
We went home.
What happened after that?
I don't remember.
Can you remember anything else that happened that day?
No, except I got knocked over by a big shaggy dog.
What is the next thing you remember? Prout sat up a little straighter and stopped squirming. Otherwise, there was little change in his demeanor.
It is night. We are in the house. He is playing with his butterfly collection.
The other boy?
Yes.
And what are you doing?
Watching him.
Do you collect butterflies, too?
No.
Why are you watching him?
I want him to come outside.
Why do you want him to come outside?
To look at the stars.
Doesn't he want to go?
No.
Why not?
It reminds him of his father. He'd rather mess with his stupid butterflies.
But you'd rather look at the stars.
Yes.
Why do you want to look at the stars?
I live there.
Among the stars?
Yes.
I remember my initial discouragement at hearing this answer. It seemed to mean that Prout's delusion had begun extremely early in life. So early, perhaps, as to preclude a determination of its causative events. But suddenly I understood. Prout was a secondary personality, whose primary was the boy whose father had died when he was 6. What is your name?
Prout.
Where do you come from?
From the planet Kapex.
Why are you here?
He wanted me to come.
Why did he want you to come?
He calls me when something bad happens.
Like when his father died?
Yes.
Did something bad happen today?
Yes.
What happened?
His dog was run over by a truck.
And that's when he called you?
Yes.
How does he do that? How does he call you?
I don't know. I just sort of know it.
How did you get to Earth?
I don't know. I just came.
Prout hadn't yet developed light travel in his mind. How old is your friend now?
9.
What year is it?
1966.
Can you tell me your friend's name now? No response. He has a name, doesn't he? Prout stared blankly at the spot on the wall behind me. I was about to go on when he said, "It's a secret. He doesn't want me to tell you." But now I knew he was in there somewhere, and Prout apparently could consult with him. Why doesn't he want you to tell me?
If I tell you, something bad will happen.
I promise you, nothing bad will happen. Tell him I said that.
All right. He still doesn't want me to tell you.
He doesn't have to tell me right now if he doesn't want to. Let's go back to the stars. Do you know where Kapex is in the sky?
Up there.
He pointed.
In the constellation Lyra.
Do you know the names of all the constellations?
Most of them.
Does your friend know the constellations too?
He used to.
Has he forgotten them?
Yes.
Is he no longer interested in them?
No.
Why not?
His father died.
His father taught him about the stars?
Yes.
He was an amateur astronomer?
Yes.
Was his father always interested in the stars?
No.
When did he become interested in them?
After he was hurt at work.
Because he had nothing to do?
No, he couldn't sleep.
Because of the pain?
Yes.
Did he sleep during the day?
Only 1 or 2 hours.
I see. And one of the constellations your friend's father told him about was Lyra.
Yes.
When?
Just before he died.
When he was 6?
Yes.
Did he ever tell him there were planets around any of the stars in Lyra?
He said there were probably planets around a lot of the stars in the sky.
One more thing. Why don't you go out and watch the stars by yourself?
I can't.
Why not?
He wants me to stay with him.
Prout yawned. He was beginning to sound tired. I didn't want to push him too far at this point. I think that's enough for one day. You may close your eyes. I'm going to start counting backwards now from 5 to 1. As I count, you will become more and more alert. On the count of 1, you will be wide awake, refreshed, and feeling fine. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. I snapped my fingers. Prout looked at me and smiled brightly.
When do we begin? He said.
It's already over.
Ah, the old fastest gun in the West routine.
I know that feeling. He had his notebook out. He wanted me to tell him how hypnosis worked. I spent the rest of the hour trying to explain something I didn't fully understand myself. He seemed a little disappointed. After Jensen and Kowalski had escorted him back to the wards, I listened to the tape of the session we had just completed and, with mounting excitement, jotted down my conclusions. It seemed clear to me that Prout was a dominant secondary personality who had come into being as a result of the perhaps unexpected death of his alter ego's father, a trauma which was obviously too much for the primary personality to bear. It seemed evident also why he, Prout, had chosen an alien existence. His, their, father had instigated in him, them, an interest in the stars and in the possibility of extraterrestrial life occurring among them, and this revelation had come immediately prior to his father's demise. But this did not account for the extraordinary dominance of Prout over the primary personality. It is the secondary identity who ordinarily remains in the background, watching, waiting to take over when the host personality runs into difficulty. My guess was that some far more traumatic event must have drawn the primary, let's call him Pete, into a thick protective shell from which he rarely, if ever, ventured. And I was more certain than ever that this terrible incident, whatever it was, occurred on August 17, 1985, the date of Prout's most recent arrival on Earth. Or perhaps a day or two earlier, if it had taken a while for Pete to call Prout, or for him to respond. Why did I not suspect that Prout was a secondary personality earlier on? MPD is not an easy diagnosis under the best of circumstances, and Prout never showed any of the symptoms usually associated with this disorder. Headaches, mood changes, a variety of physical ailments, depression. Except possibly for his outbursts of anger in sessions 6 and 8, and the episode of panic on the 4th of July, the host personality, Pete, had never made his presence felt. Finally, I was completely thrown off by his other aberrant traits, a dominant secondary personality who is himself delusional, and a savant as well. The odds against such a phenomenon must be astronomical. But who was Pete, the primary personality? Apparently he was in there, somewhere, living the life of a recluse in his own body,
refusing to divulge his name or much of his background, except that he was born in 1957, apparently, to a slaughterhouse worker who died in 1963, perhaps, somewhere in the northwestern part of the United States, and he had a mother and two older sisters. Not much to go on, but it might help the police trace his origin. Strictly speaking, it was Pete's identity rather than Prout's that we needed to ascertain. Any information we could get about him, any knowledge of things familiar to him, might facilitate my persuading him to come out. All this put Prout's departure date into an entirely new light. It is one thing for a patient to announce an end to a delusion, but quite another for a dominant alter to disappear, leaving behind a hysteric, or maybe worse. If Prout were to leave before I could get to Pete, it might well preclude my ever being able to help him at all. I wondered whether the unhypnotized Prout knew anything about Pete. If not, the plan would remain as before, to bring Prout, Pete, slowly and carefully under hypnosis, up to the time of the traumatic event, or events, which precipitated Pete's dramatic withdrawal from conscious existence. Even if he did know about Pete, however, hypnosis might still be necessary, both to facilitate Prout's recollection and to make possible direct contact with the host's personality. But there was a dilemma associated with this approach. On the one hand, I needed to talk to Pete as soon as possible. On the other, forcing him to relive that terrible moment prematurely could be devastating and cause him to withdraw even further into his protective shell. Giselle seemed a little less cheerful than usual the following Monday morning.
My friend down at the 6th Precinct couldn't find any report of a missing person who disappeared from the Upper West in August of 1985, she said, consulting a little red notebook, much like the one Prout was fond of. Somebody killed a man and then himself in a little town in Montana on the 16th of that month, and in Boise on the 18th, another guy ran off with his secretary and $150,000 of his company's funds. But your guy isn't dead, and the one who ran off with his secretary is still in the Idaho State Penitentiary. My friend is expanding the search to cover January through July of 1985, and then all of the United States and Canada. It will be a while before he gets the results. I also know someone in the research library at New York Public. During her break, she's doing some searches for me for the week of August 17th. You know, newspaper reports of anything unusual that might have happened during that period in Montana, Idaho, Washington, and Oregon. Nothing there so far, either.
She closed the little book.
Of course, she added, he might have been raised in the Northwest and then moved somewhere else.
I told her about Prout's, Pete's father, and the slaughterhouse.
Ha, she replied. I wonder how many of those things there are in the United States.
I don't know.
I'll find out, she said with a wave.
Wait a minute, I called after her. He was born in 1957.
How did you find this stuff out? She demanded to know.
We have our ways, mein Mädchen.
She ran back and kissed me on the mouth, almost, before dashing out. I felt about 13 years old again.
Karen and I were inseparable after my father's funeral. If we could have lived together, we would have. I especially loved her fat, pink cheeks, which became red and shiny in the wintertime. But it took me another year to get up the nerve to kiss her. I studied the way they did it in the movies, practiced for months on the back of my hand. The problem was, I wasn't sure she wanted me to. Not that she turned away whenever our faces were close together, but she never indicated in any clear way that she was interested. Finally, I decided to do it. With all those movies, it seemed abnormal not to. We were sitting on the sofa at her house reading Donald Duck comics, and I had been thinking about it all morning. I knew you were supposed to kiss sort of sideways so your noses wouldn't bang together, and when she turned toward me to show me Donald's nephews carrying picket signs reading Uncle Donald is stupid, I made my move. I missed, of course,
as first kisses often do, as Giselle's did before she ran out. That afternoon I found Giselle in the exercise room talking animatedly with Prout. La Belle was asleep in his lap. Both were jotting things down.